religion of his friend.
That is very true.
That's a famous hadith, and yes, it is so.
Like, yeah, it is so.
That's why we have to be picky. We have to be choosy.
So characteristics does matter.
Of course they do. Mm-hmm. And like Imam Ali alayhi salam teaches you in many of the hadiths,
yeah,
how to choose, what qualities does a friend have, should have, you know. So we have all those lists in,
yeah,
Islamic teachings. Like Imam says, like, you should be checking a friend in a difficult, mm-hmm, time. If your friend shows up.
Yeah.
Yes. But I think over here as well, we have, like, just have some confusions. For example, if someone was not available for you in your difficult time.
Yes.
You should first analyze things. Why? Why did not the person come up?
And what are going to be the answers? Usually with no answer.
No, of course. If you analyze, it will come up with answers. See? Was the other person aware of my situation or, mm-hmm, not? If he was aware and did not come up, yes, you can think like that.
Yeah.
If the other person was unaware of the situation you were going through and you're expecting he should have stood by me, that's a wrong expectation.
Yeah.
Hey, you cannot judge that this friend of mine was a fake friend of mine. This friend of mine was a real friend of mine. And these fake kind of friends that we are talking about, they will constantly try to make you feel guilty.
Yeah, feel bad about yourself.
Feel bad about yourself using those passive-aggressive behaviors.
They would always drag you down.
Drag you down.
Yeah,
you're not,
that would be very bad.
Yeah, so that way you lose your confidence, you lose self-esteem, mm-hmm, you lose so many things. So even if you are not wrong, like the real friends, we started, mm-hmm, with the word real friends. Real friends are the ones who accept you the way you are.
That is the most beautiful thing we said today.
Yeah. I mean, the way you are, the way you look.
Yeah, and for
the country you're
from. Wherever you are.
From wherever you are.
Yes.
They don't look for borders. They don't look for color. They don't,
exactly,
look for race. They look for nothing. Yeah. Except
just
you.
Just two souls getting all along together and making that.
Except you the way you are.
Connection. Yes. That is very nice. So we should also consider that point,
yeah,
very carefully.
Accepting you the way you are, and then, like,
yes,
especially when you have some hard times and they are,
mm-hmm,
there for you. And when you are successful, they're happy for your success.
Uh-huh.
It's important again.
Yeah, it is very important.
Not
so
just
they shouldn't
being
be envious.
Jealous.
Yes, jealousy, envious.
Yeah, because jealousy shows it all.
Yeah.
Jealousy shows it all.
Real friends, they turn out to be like your siblings. They would,
yeah,
be happy for your happiness and they would be sad for your sorrows. And it's very, very interesting to have such friends.
They'll encourage you for your ambitions.
Yeah, that is very
true. They'll help you.
Just like what you do to me. You always give me so much of energy.
Thank you, Asma. I mean, I have had, I for so many years, mm-hmm, thought one of the persons was my friends, but and I always loved anchoring. I wanted to anchor programs. And the first opportunity that I got in Iran, and she was like, one should work to become a guest lecturer, not to be an anchor. Well, as I told her, I always wanted to be an anchor.
Yes.
Because as an anchor, you experience so many different things. You ask,
yeah,
questions. You meet all those celebrities or guest speakers or,
yeah,
religious personalities and stuff. But, again, discouraging. So, hey, you realize, basically, is the person with
so
me or
her.
Is the person against me?
Yeah.
Is the person feeling, giving me courage or is the person discouraging me? So with your success or with your, like, every happiness, that person should be happy.
They
should not put you down for their own opinions,
that.
You know?
You know, duplicity in friendship is very bad.
That
in
is.
Your face, they show,
yeah,
you that they're good with you. And when you're not there, they would do the other way.
Yeah. And Asma, do you know, is there any person who is without flaws?
Oh, of course there is no one. Nobody's perfect.
And for your flaws, these fake ones will come and, like, kind of so harshly judge you over those flaws. This is one more point, like, where I...
Actually, there's a very delicate point in here. See, we said that a friend must be a mirror that shows you all your flaws.
Exactly.
But also, we have this very point that they should not criticize you very harshly.
Even if they are trying to tell you your flaws, they should be... You have to see where this person is telling my flaws.
Yeah.
Where exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And how did this person come into my life? Did he come into, like, in a flattering mode? Or, like, it was natural with the flow?
Yeah. But usually, talking about the characteristics of a real friend is a very hard job. And it takes a lot of things to say about it.
There are a lot of things. One more thing that's coming into my mind just is, like, they would never initiate get-togethers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They would never initiate them. And, like, you have to be always the one you have to catch up yourself. So they won't be the ones who will be initiating those get-ups and all get-togethers.
So, guys, be picky and very much meticulous when it comes to picking friends.
And not like us... the verse I mentioned of Surah Furqan, the verse number 28, which says that...
Do not let the day come when you feel regretful and say, I wish I had never picked that guy.
I wish I had never spent
my precious time with that person
who
ruined everything. So, dear listeners, I wish you all find your real friends. And thank you for listening. This was all the time that we had for today's episode. Until another session, from me and the entire cast of Youth Station, I bid you farewell. May Allah bless you forever. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi
wa barakatuhu.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The historic trilateral summit in Tehran on 19th of July between the presidents of Iran, Russia and Turkey illustrated that due to Iran's unique geopolitical position, it has become a hub for diplomatic negotiations to address regional and international crises. We now present you an article written by Arwin Qaemian, a PhD student at Tehran University, with expertise in Iran's modern history as well as West Asia's socio-economic and security issues. The piece is titled Iran-Russia Strategic Alliance, What Iran Gained from Putin's Visit. The most significant outcome of the trilateral summit in Tehran on 19th of July between the presidents of Iran, Russia and Turkey was the formation of a roadmap to resolve regional crises, leading to a dramatic shift in the world order and a subsequent decline of the United States hegemony in the West Asia region. The historic summit illustrated that due to Iran's unique geopolitical position, it has become a hub for diplomatic negotiations to address regional and international crises. Strengthening economic, military and political cooperation between the two all-weather allies, Russia and Iran, figured prominently on the agenda of the summit. Iran and Russia have maintained robust cooperation over the last few decades, and their anti-Western stance has contributed to developing joint political economic strategies. It seems that an emerging alliance between Tehran and Moscow to thwart the US-NATO hegemony has been reinforced by recent developments in Eastern Europe and in Central Asia, and also by Western sanctions on Russia's energy industry. Since the beginning of Russia's special operation in Ukraine, this was the first time the Russian leader Vladimir Putin traveled anywhere outside of the former Soviet Union. By choosing Tehran as a destination, Vladimir Putin explicitly signaled to his Western adversaries that Moscow is seeking to reinforce his position on the Eastern Front by strengthening relations with its ally, the Islamic Republic of Iran. According to observers, one of Iran's main gains from the trilateral summit was the offer of a $40 billion Russian state-owned Gazprom investment contract in Iran. Under the terms of the preliminary agreement, Gazprom will assist the National Iranian Oil Company, NIOC, in developing oil and gas fields and constructing liquefied natural gas pipelines. In addition, the agreement involves a project worth $10 billion in the Kish Island and North Pass gas fields in the Persian Gulf, as well as a vast program worth $15 billion to enhance operational activities in the South Pass gas field, which is the largest gas field shared by Iran and Qatar. Mohsen Khojastemir, director of the National Iranian Oil Company, NIOC, described this memorandum as one of the biggest foreign investments in the history of Iran's oil industry. Underlining the energy cooperation between Tehran and Moscow, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said in a communique, "The long-term cooperation between Iran and Russia is very beneficial to both countries. There are agreements and contracts between the two countries, notably in the oil and gas sectors, that must be pursued and fully implemented. Given that Ukraine has become an existential priority for Russia and there is a need for Russian troops and equipment in Ukraine's entrenched conflict, there will ultimately be a military vacuum in Syria, which Moscow does not want the United States and the Takfiri terrorist groups to fill." During the last week's summit in Tehran, it was reported that Vladimir Putin asked Iran to maintain its advisory presence east of the river Euphrates. This strategically key area has long been of utmost importance to Iran and its ally, Syria. According to observers, amid the departure of U.S. occupying forces from eastern Syria, the reopening of the Iran-Iraq-Syria corridor would likely lead to the connection of Iran to the Mediterranean Sea. In other words, if achieved, this key initiative would resurrect the ancient Silk Road, which will definitely have financial advantages for all countries in West Asia region and the wider international community. Tuesday's landmark summit came as Turkey has constantly been threatening since late May to launch a large-scale military onslaught in northern Syria, where it seeks to create a 30-kilometer buffer zone on the border and eliminate the YPG Kurdish militants that Ankara deems as terrorists. However, Tehran and Moscow have both already voiced their vehement opposition to such an invasion. During his meeting with Iran's leader, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was again warned that any military offensive against Syrian territorial integrity would be detrimental to Turkey and to the region as a whole. He was exhorted to resolve the crisis through diplomatic means. Since the beginning of the armed insurgency in Syria in 2011, Russia and Iran have supported the democratically elected Syrian government, whereas Turkey has backed the opposition and the foreign-backed militants in the northern Idlib province of Turkey. Before President Vladimir Putin's visit to Tehran, Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson, was cited as saying in an interview with an Iranian state television channel that Iran and Russia will soon sign a treaty on strategic cooperation, expanding their cooperation in the banking and financial sectors, and abandoning the use of the US dollar to dominate their commerce. Nasser Gandil, a prominent Lebanese commentator, argues that the rising international economic powers known as BRICS, headed by Russia, China, India, and Iran's imminent admission to the BRICS group, is a great success. BRICS will support the growth and development of independent economies and boost the volume of investment and trade exchanges by replacing the US dollar and the euro with their own national currencies to render the American sanctions utterly ineffective. Russia's special military operation in Ukraine against NATO's vicious encroachments and recent strategic and economic ties with Iran following President Vladimir Putin's visit to Tehran was a clear indication to the US-led Western bloc that the Moscow-Tehran relationship is metamorphosing into a genuine strategic partnership as the war in Ukraine alters the Russian economic perspective. Today, both Moscow and Tehran are under harsh and cruel sanctions by the United States and the Western bloc. Thus, the Kremlin regards Iran as an indispensable economic partner and seeks to utilize Iran's expertise in circumventing U.S. unilateral sanctions by substituting the rial and the ruble for the U.S. dollar. Today, the Kremlin has accelerated efforts to move away from the U.S. dollar after the United States and its allies imposed unprecedented sanctions to punish Russia for its military operation in Ukraine. President Putin said he discussed the increased use of national currencies in trade with the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. In the light of the fact that Western bloc has imposed an embargo on Russian maritime and aviation trade, Iran will be a viable channel for the passage of Russian commodities, as the shortest path for Russian goods to reach the main ports of the Persian Gulf, which is through the Iranian railroad to the strategic port city of Bandar Abbas in southern Iran. It is evident that the north-south corridor will provide enormous transit revenues for the Iranian state coffer. During the recent visit of the Russian President Vladimir Putin to Tehran and his meetings with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Vladimir Putin stressed the importance of completing the Rasht-Astara railway and operating the north-south corridor.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Principles of Friendship. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, dear listeners. My name is Hussein Hinzano, and you're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. In today's lesson, we want to talk about principles of friendship. And the main point that we're talking about in these particular minutes is how to be a successful friend. Among the principles of friendship is for us to check on how we can be successful friends whenever we are planning to start any relationship in our lives. Whenever we are planning to start any relationship in our lives, friendship relationship, partnership relationship, or whatever it is, we need, first of all, to consider that. How can we make this relationship be successful? How can I gain out of this relationship? And how can my partner, the one that I want him to be my friend, how can he gain from me? And by gaining, we're not talking of material purposes. We're not talking of worldly matters, worldly issues. No. When we are talking about how can I gain, how can I add something in my life, add value in my life through this particular person, we are talking about us building each other intellectually, spiritually, habitually, socially. How can I build the social life of my friend and make it a good social life? If my friend is having a problem in his social life, if my friend have a low self-esteem, what can I do in my life until I help him improve his self-esteem in front of people? How can I help him do that? That's what we need to consider for us to have a successful friendship. Considering that the particular person I'm living with, I need to make sure that apart from knowing them, I need to make sure that I am doing my best to improve them. So among the best things for us to consider is for us to make sure that we are helping our friends be better than we made them, and vice versa. Them too should be considering the same. And that way, definitely we will head and we will lead ourselves to successful relationships, to successful friendships.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to A to Z program from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the principles of friendship. And we were talking about a very important thing, and that was how to be a successful friendship, or how to build a successful friendships. Now, we say that one of the things is for us to make sure that we are doing our best to improve our partners, to make them good in whatever they are weak at, in whatever they need. Now, the Holy Quran has outlined the sacrifices made by the righteous companions of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The companions of the Holy Prophet, the Sahaba of the Holy Prophet, lived in a sincere friendship. They had a good friendship between them. For example, the Ansar. Who are the Ansar? The people of Medina. The people of Medina sacrificed and presented all of what the Muhajirun, or the people of Mecca. The Ansar are the people of Medina, and the Muhajirun are the people of Mecca. Now, the people of Medina, the Ansar, sacrificed and presented all of what the Muhajirun needed. The time the Muhajirun came, they provided them shelter, food, clothes, money, even if they're in need of these things themselves. You see, the Ansar weren't really rich people. We cannot say they were rich people, but they did their best to provide what the Muhajirun needed in their life. Why? They were seeking nothing except Allah's pleasure. And as we said, when you're trying to build your friend, when you're trying to improve your friend's life, make sure that you're seeking nothing except Allah's pleasure and not the worldly issues, not the worldly matters. The Holy Quran says in chapter 59, verse number 9, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم, and those who made their abode in the city and in faith before them, love those who have fled to them. It's referring to the issue of the Ansar and the Muhajirun.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
Before Sarah Matthews, a former Deputy White House Press Secretary, even opened her mouth to testify on Thursday, 21st of July, before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th assault on the Capitol, the House Republican Conference attacked her on Twitter as a liar and a pawn of Democrats. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by Annie Carney and Maggie Haberman, two journalists writing for the New York Times. The piece is titled, In January 6 Hearings, Gender Divide Has Been Strong Undercurrent. Before Sarah Matthews, a former Deputy White House Press Secretary, even opened her mouth to testify on Thursday, 21st of July, before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th assault on the Capitol, the House Republican Conference attacked her on Twitter as a liar and a pawn of Democrats. The group did not mention the man seated beside her, Matthew Pottinger, the former Deputy National Security Advisor, who was also there to issue a scathing indictment of President Donald J. Trump's behavior on the day of the riot. Nor did Donald Trump himself mention Mr. Pottinger when he lashed out hours later with a statement calling Sarah Matthews a fame seeker who was clearly lying. The contrast highlighted how, in a series of revelatory hearings that have focused on issues of democracy, the rule of law and the peaceful transfer of power, another less discussed theme has emerged. The gender dynamics that have been a potent undercurrent. In the course of exposing Donald Trump's elaborate effort to overturn the 2020 election, the House Select Committee has relied on the accounts of several women who came forward to publicly tell their stories. Their statements and the attacks that ensued laid bare how women often still pay a higher price than men for speaking up. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming and the vice chairwoman of the panel, a woman who herself has suffered heavy consequences for her insistence on publicly condemning Donald Trump's conduct, has been explicit about the role of gender in the proceedings. She has positioned herself as the champion of the women who have agreed to testify in public, comparing them favorably with the many men who have refused to do so. At the committee's primetime hearing on Thursday, 21st of July, Liz Cheney wore a white jacket, the colour of the women's suffrage movement. She invoked Margaret Thatcher, the first woman to serve as Prime Minister of Britain, and the fight by American women to secure the right to vote, as she described the women who had publicly appeared during the panel's investigation as an inspiration to American women and American girls. She was referring to Sarah Matthews as well as Cassidy Hutchinson, another White House aide who appeared at one of the committee's hearings. Caroline Edwards, a Capitol police officer who testified about how she was assaulted by the rioters, sustained a concussion and continued to fight them off. And Wandria Moss and her mother, Ruby Freeman, election workers from Georgia, who told the panel about how they endured harassment and even death threats after Donald Trump named them in a false conspiracy theory about voter fraud. The result has been that as the committee unfurls the story of the January 6th attack, playing footage of a mostly male crowd laying waste to the Capitol in Donald Trump's name, with the president looking on supportively from the West Wing, many of the witnesses who have emerged most prominently have been women, with Liz Cheney as their defender. It is a notable strategy by Liz Cheney, a tough and hawkish conservative who throughout her career has worked to avoid being viewed through the lens of gender. It comes as the Republican Party has labored to diversify and expand its appeal among female voters, a group that polls showed was a weak spot for Donald Trump in 2020 and has only drifted from him since. A recent New York Times Siena College poll found that 6 in 10 women believed Mr. Trump's actions after the 2020 election threatened democracy, while men were almost evenly split, with 48% holding that view and 45% saying he was just exercising his rights. Liz Cheney was the highest-ranking Republican woman on Capitol Hill last year when she broke with her party after the riot and called out Donald Trump and his election lies, voting to impeach him for incitement of insurrection. Within months, she had been ousted as the number 3 Republican in the House, and she is now at risk of losing her seat in Wyoming as she faces a challenging primary election next month against a Trump-endorsed opponent. It was difficult not to hear some parallels when Liz Cheney described on Thursday how Cassidy Hutchinson, the 26-year-old former White House aide who became a critical public witness, knowingly exposed herself to harsh criticism from former colleagues. Ms. Cheney said that Ms. Hutchinson knew all along that she would be attacked by President Trump and by the 50, 60, and 70-year-old men who hide themselves behind executive privilege. But like our witnesses today, she has courage and she did it anyway, Liz Cheney added. After Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, Donald Trump dismissed her in an interview with Newsmax as this girl who was making up stories. "She's got serious problems, let me put it that way," he said, "mental problems." Amanda Carpenter, a former advisor to Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Jim DeMint of South Carolina, both Republicans, said it was notable to see a conservative woman drawing attention to the gender dynamic. "I know how hard it is for these women under these circumstances," Ms. Carpenter said. "I imagine it means a lot to the women being targeted. It means a lot to me just watching it." The Twitter attack by the House Republican Conference on Sarah Matthews, who works as a House Republican aide, was quickly deleted. But Donald Trump's targeting of her and Cassidy Hutchinson was in line with how the former president has often publicly treated women who challenge him, criticizing them in personal terms intended to call into question their credibility, their sanity, and self-worth. Donald Trump's allies like to describe him as an equal opportunity counterpuncher who would attack anyone who crossed him. But over the years, he has singled out female antagonists with particular viciousness, including the television personalities Mika Brzezinski and Megyn Kelly, Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, and Mary T. Barra, the chief executive of General Motors. His allies, many of them seeking his approval, have mimicked his behavior. In the case of Cassidy Hutchinson, a person close to her said, stories have been shopped to Trump-friendly media outlets, smearing her personally. Garrett Ziegler, a junior aide in Donald Trump's White House, went on a misogynistic rant during a live stream this past week after sitting for an interview with the January 6th committee in which he repeatedly refused to answer questions. In the rant, he used sexist slurs against his former female colleagues who have cooperated with the inquiry. Pat Cipollone, Bill Barr, Mark Short, they're saying the same thing, yet you attack the young women, said former Representative Barbara Comstock of Virginia, a Republican whom Mr. Trump, in the past, branded as a rhino loser, for Republican in name only. Barbara Comstock was referring to the former White House counsel, the former Attorney General, and the former Chief of Staff to Vice President Mike Pence, all of whom gave closed-door testimony to the committee that painted Donald Trump in an unflattering light. This is a pattern, said Barbara Comstock, who is close to Liz Cheney. The president does this, and this is intentional. Some of the male witnesses have also suffered professional consequences and public rebukes for their candor. Rusty Bowers, the Arizona House Speaker and a Republican, was censured by his state's Republican Party after his emotional testimony before the committee. Mr. Bowers, who is running for re-election, told NBC News that it would take a miracle for him to survive politically. And William Barr, who as Attorney General directly told Donald Trump that his claims of election fraud had no merit, echoed the sentiment about the realities of cooperation. "I get a lot of vitriol from the right," William Barr said in a brief interview. Yet while male witnesses have received some criticism from the right, in Mr. Cipollone's case, Donald Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., tweeted that he should grow a spine and go on record. The attacks have not been at the same volume or intensity or of the same degree of personal nastiness as those against Cassidy Hutchinson in particular. Donald Trump's allies insist they have substantive concerns about what Cassidy Hutchinson has told the committee. They have raised specific challenges on matters of fact in her testimony, honing in on a discrepancy between her account and that of Eric Hirschman, a former White House lawyer. Each has claimed authorship of a handwritten note displayed at one of the hearings that provided instructions for what the president could have told the rioters on 6 of January 2021. There has also been an effort to undermine the veracity of some of the most explosive parts of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony. Secret Service officials who spoke to reporters on the condition of anonymity disputed a scene that Ms. Hutchinson said that she had been told about, in which Donald Trump was said to have grabbed a Secret Service agent and lunged for the steering wheel of the SUV he was riding in as he demanded to be driven to the Capitol on 6 of January 2021. But the swiftness of the Twitter attack on Sarah Matthews was notable given that it came from her own colleagues. The Twitter account for the House Republican conference that singled her out is run by two former Trump campaign aides. Under the stewardship of Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, who replaced Liz Cheney as the number three House Republican, the Twitter account has taken on an aggressive tone throughout the hearings, intended to please the proverbial audience of one.
We are with you. What about you?
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. If you use a divine blessing in the right place, God will increase that blessing for you. This is a divine tradition. As for those who strive hard for us, we will most certainly guide them in our ways, and Allah is most surely with the doers of good. The Holy Quran, Surah 29, verse 69. All of these are divine traditions. In a meeting in this Husayniya several years ago, I once talked about the story when Moses saved the children of Israel. He led them towards the sea in the middle of the night so that they could escape. The next day, or the day after, it's not exactly clear in history, Pharaoh realized they had left and followed them.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They, the children of Israel, were walking and moving along with difficulty, while Pharaoh's army had horses and they were riding. When Pharaoh's army approached and could see the people, but when the Holy Quran says, but when the two parties came in sight of each other, the Holy Quran, Surah 8, verse 48, the people of Moses turned to him and said, most surely we are being overtaken. The Holy Quran, Surah 26, verse 61. The people of Moses, who were cowardly and had little faith, told Moses, most surely we are being overtaken. They said, they will now come and get us. That's the end of us. Moses told them, by no means, surely my Lord is with me. The Holy Quran, Surah 26, verse 62. Moses told them that God is with him. This is a divine tradition. All of these are divine traditions. The divine traditions are laws. How do laws work? The law is about a certain situation, and it has a decree or a result. If you put yourself in that situation, the result will definitely come. If you help the cause of Allah, He will help you. The Holy Quran, Surah 47, verse 7. Helping the cause of God is the situation in this verse. If you help God, the result and decree is His helping you. If you put yourself in this situation, the result will surely come. There is no doubt in this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
We all remember her from pictures. At the time that her father was assassinated, Armita Rezai Nejad was only 5. Her mother, Shohreh Pirani, was also wounded in the attack. Today, her story has found its way on the silver screen, revealing new dimensions of how Dariush Rezai Nejad was martyred. What made the ordeal even tougher was the fact that Dariush was shot right in front of his wife and his 5-year-old daughter. The international community, human rights advocates, and even the UN remained silent. This prompted Shohreh Pirani to write a letter to then-US Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, denouncing in the strongest terms the assassination of researchers and scientists. Her move inspired a group of filmmakers to make a movie based on the story.
About 5 or 6 years ago, we decided to make this movie. I believe that as filmmakers, we had a responsibility to do so.
This is a very important part of our contemporary history. It's a story that just had to be told. It should have been done sooner.
I was preoccupied by this incident for years. How can you kill someone right in front of his 5-year-old kid? I did some research, and as soon as the opportunity came up, we decided to make the movie.
Hanas, which literally means breath, is a biopic that dramatizes the story of Dariush Rezai Nejad, a nuclear scientist that was assassinated in 2011.
This movie is actually a document that shows how Iran has been a victim of terror attacks. There aren't many countries in which such brutal terror attacks have happened. The assassination of a scientist and researcher while his family is watching.
This was a very educational movie showing us the animosity of Israel and the United States.
I found it to be an educational movie, both important and interesting.
I learned a lot. It was very interesting.
The feminine touch has turned this biopic into a must-see, and now, in an open letter, Armita has called on all foreign ambassadors in Iran to watch the movie, too.
In the words of Armita, the daughter of the martyred scientist Dariush Rezai Nejad, Iranian or non-Iranian, everyone should watch this movie just to catch a glimpse of the atrocities and human rights violations that are committed against the Iranian people, while the international community remains silent. Kisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
South Korean peace activists gathered at Imjingak, a peace park near the border with North Korea, to call for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. They also want the agreements made during previous inter-Korean summits to be upheld.
Let's join together, 80 million people for peace. Let's get together, people for peace around the world. Let's start today the great journey of marking the 70th anniversary of the armistice. Next year, the year of the end of the war, and the first year of the peace agreement.
Peace activists traveled in groups from across South Korea to join the event. Former President Moon Jae-in had sought engagement with North Korea, but his push for an inter-Korean peace failed to materialize. Participants here want results.
We gathered here because everyone wants to keep a state of peace in the middle of this tension. We hope this will expand and be transmitted to the so-called politicians in South Korea and the world, so that peace can be achieved politically.
We believe that, after all, politicians have some responsibility for the Korean Peninsula issue, but our citizens need to show some of the world's political leaders that the general public wants an end to the Korean War.
The Korean peace appeal seeks 100 million signatures to deliver to the United Nations and the warring parties next year. New South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is taking a hard line with North Korea, boosting the country's military and strengthening its alliance with the United States, with joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises planned for next month. Advocates for peace, like those gathered here today, have an uphill battle. Frank Smith, South Korea.
A gathering of Lebanese journalists and activists was held in the South Lebanon town of Naqoura to protest against Israel's extraction activities in the disputed waters.
We are so powerful, we can fight, we can go to war in case the enemy wants a war, unless we get our rights and our wealth in the sea and on the land.
Former head of the Lebanese negotiating team told Press TV that any negotiator should use all sources of power in his hands to strengthen their position facing the other party.
One of the strongest point is the resistance and the position of the resistance in the negotiation or for asking for getting what is right for Lebanon.
The speakers believe that Israeli attempts to drill in disputed waters could escalate the current status quo.
The Lebanese community and the media community is behind the Lebanese negotiation and behind the Lebanese resistance to confirm our right and in our wealth.
Within the presence of the resistance, as well as the army of Lebanon and the people who refuse such aggression, because we believe that this act is already an aggression against Lebanon, and we have all the right to give a response to it, whether it is a legal response or any form of diplomatic or political or any form of response within our power of nation.
We came here, Lebanese government and people and press, to make the line and the point that this is our land and this is our sea and this is our sky.
Israeli caretaker Minister Yair Lapid has told U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein that he wants to make a deal with Lebanon over the disputed waters as soon as possible. This comes a week after Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said the resistance is ready for military escalation if Western pressure to prevent Lebanon from extracting its resources continues. Hochstein is expected in Beirut later in July.
We are here in Naqoura, the last Lebanese town on Lebanon's south coast. From here, at least three lines have been drawn in efforts to demarcate the maritime borders, all of which remain disputed, and nine, both potentially rich in gas and petrol. But Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, says Western pressure has hampered extraction activities. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Verets, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians, and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist. After he is killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mira Tervets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported, and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism.
They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. But like the old saying is that the other's one's terrorist is another one's freedom fighter. And hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
As the United Nations is pushing the warring sites in Yemen to renew the truce, the Sana'a government has set new conditions to accept the extension for a third period of 6 months. The head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, said the United Nations is now required to ensure the payment of all salaries which are suspended since 2016.
If the leadership in Sana'a accept the extension of the truce, the commitment under the agreement should be implemented from the first day of the truce. The blockade must be lifted by land, sea and air. All roads must be opened, and the salaries of Yemeni employees must be paid. The oil wells must be preserved, and the suffering of prisoners should be ended. Without this, the truce has no meaning.
Experts say it is likely that Sana'a rejects the terms of the current truce and pushes the United Nations to further ease the suffering of Yemenis by dispersing salaries.
It is clear from the political and military statements of Sana'a that they will not accept the request to extend the ceasefire easily. There are new demands by Sana'a to enter a third period of the agreement. The United Nations must fulfill previous commitments and deal with the new conditions positively. Otherwise, there will be a military escalation.
Yemen's demands come against the backdrop of United Nations' failure to force the Saudi-led coalition to fulfill its commitments under the current agreement that was brokered by the world body in early April.
Disappointing and useless, that's how Yemenis describe the current UN brokered agreement. They say the Yemeni army should be prepared for different scenarios, including military escalation. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Okay.
Due to their decision to sanction Russia over the unrest in Ukraine, France and the European Union are desperately trying to build energy stocks ahead of this winter. However, a record heat wave has created a surge in energy consumption, and that's prompted